have a few minutes and perhaps three or four questions from you would be in order. Give the panel the flavor of your interest and give you a chance to get a response to a few questions. Would someone like to put a question? If you'd just give your name and your affiliation and then a very brief question, we'd appreciate it.
Paul Bradley, I'm with the University of British
Columbia. I'll repeat this so you...
I'd like to direct a question to Mr. Gallagher, who has spoken of a continental oil policy. My question is this. Mr. Beckus's projections in slide number 2 show crude deficits in U.S. areas that would absorb Alaska crude. And if I interpreted his other slide correctly, slide number 1, he showed constant imports to the United States from Canada. So my question is, in talking of a continental policy, do you envision that the continental market will absorb all Arctic crude? Or, if I could put the question a different way, if you had to depend on the world market, or say with world market prices, would drilling in the Canadian Arctic stop?
Did you hear that for the most part? It's a question to Mr. Gallagher based on Mr. Eckes' picture of the future, which showed a supply deficit from the ordinary sources of oil for which North Slope and Arctic oil might come in and supply it. And you may have to help me out here. The question to Mr. Gallagher goes to this. What will be the role of Canada?
Let me shout a little louder. I think I had too much.
We're going to use up all our time on the first question, so come up here very quickly and state it briefly, if you will. I think if you just put your main question, it would be helpful.
Thank you. The question has been raised of a continental oil policy, and I wanted to ask Mr. Gallagher if he pictured the continental market absorbing all Arctic crude, whether it was Alaskan or Canadian, and put the question just a slightly different way. If he were dependent on sales on the world market instead of just the protected U.S. market, would drilling in the Arctic, in the Canadian Arctic, stop?
I don't think this is working. Is this working?
We can't hear it back here. First of all, the supply deficit. Certainly, I didn't imply or wish to imply that North America would not be supplied partially by offshore imports. The suggestion of an import tariff for offshore oil coming in to North America, in effect, would partially restrict oil from other areas, but within that sort of protection or umbrella, Canadian crude, Alaskan crude, Arctic Island crude would have to compete, in effect, to supply the domestic market. And certainly we feel in the Canadian Arctic, as in the North Slope, you're looking for elephants. The cost is high, but the returns and the quantities that you anticipate finding would more than offset that. Secondly, it takes a long time to really develop large producibility in these areas, and there would be certain adjustments to be made during that period. By a continental oil policy, all I was suggesting was that it was a continental energy policy, that we in Canada import a great deal of coal. We export a certain amount of electricity. We feel that the barriers towards the free, unrestricted movement of energy, both north and south, across the 49th, is a very important part of being strong in North America. I believe that may answer it, but again, we would continue to explore in the Arctic Islands, in the fact we feel that that oil can compete within the domestic market and can also compete possibly in Europe, where the Arctic Islands are only 3,700 miles from Western Europe. And in this way, Western Europe, as Japan, wants to have a certain percentage of their demand taken care of from politically stable countries and are willing to pay a premium in order to have that sort of a supply.
Another question. Loud as you can.
I'd like to ask Mr. Gallagher a question. I'd like to ask him what he's going to do about Eskimo rights in the Arctic in regards to the oil companies in Canada, Arctic.
First of all, there are no Eskimos in the Arctic Islands. The Eskimos, as you may know, live on the mainland, and there have been a few families moved into Resolute, which is one of the more southerly bases in the Arctic Islands. But we have no Eskimos or any inhabitants as such in the Arctic Islands. Now, other parts of Canada are being explored in the north, namely the Mackenzie Delta and the around the Inuvik area and the offshore sector. There's a considerable education and training program going on now with the hope that Eskimos will be able to fit in to the drilling and the exploration and the production effort in those areas. And we hope by the time that we really mount the program in that sector that we'll have a number of indigenous people who can work in this industry.
Is this after the oil companies clear out?
We didn't hear you.
Is this after the oil companies clear out of the north? I happen to come from an Arctic island where the sovereignty is in dispute from Banks Island, and my ancestors were on Melville Island, and our graves are there. So is that, we're not getting any benefits from the oil company.
Well, first of all, we in our company have been in the Arctic Islands for the last 12 or 11 years. We have covered Melville very carefully, and there's no sign of indigenous life there other than a few trips overland from a whaling point of view where they would probably winter on the island. In essence, there's no reason why the oil companies are going to clear out. In the fact, we feel that bringing people into the Arctic areas of both Alaska and Canada is very important, because by bringing people who have something else to do other than sit there and report the weather conditions, somebody who has something in the way of a research program, a search for oil and gas, we're going to also have people there who are going to learn how to live in those areas and help those people who are there. We don't feel we're invading the area. We think we're there to help the area.
One final question. Who would like to ask it? Yes, here, right here.
I would like to ask Mr. Eckes, do the oil companies have a plan to establish industry in Alaska with oil byproducts? I understand they make all sorts of things, textiles and so on. Our, as an Alaska citizen, our great need is for work to do every day throughout the state.
There is no plan, no industry plan at the moment, although there are studies underway to determine what can be done in this respect, to locate plants for byproduct here and so forth. There are two small refineries projected at this time. And I think that there's no question but that as the population of Alaska grows and the labor market increases and the demand for product even here increases, that you will see some byproduct plants developed here in Alaska. We have the tremendous sources of gas, which offer raw material as well as oil. These are things which will have to come in time, but the industry is very much cognizant of this, and I think I can say that you will see some. Good.
Thank you. Before concluding this first session of this remarkable Alaska Science Conference, I'd like to make a personal observation along the human interest side of oil development in the North. Way back near the beginning, Professor Edelman said that the North Slope oil development would be small potatoes in terms of the world oil picture of supply and movement and markets. Of course, it will be big potatoes for Alaska if it comes off. And it will be significant potatoes for a certain number of other people scattered around the country and the globe. Last week, last Friday, to be exact, I was in the vicinity of Machiasport, Maine. This apparently is the only place on the East Coast of the United States where big oil tankers drawing up to 70 or 80 feet can get in close to shore in reasonably protected waters. Now, I happen to have spent much of my boyhood in that down east country, and having also spent some time as a young adult in Alaska, the prospective linking of these two places in a new linkage of oil source, transport, refining, consumption carries a special interest for me. Who would have thought that Kenny Woods, who early every morning pulls lobster pots in Machias Bay, would ever have much concern over what happens on the North Slope of Alaska? Or who would have thought that, these are friends of mine, who would have thought that Mark Nault of Machias, editor of the Washington County Times, would have had much interest? Or who would have thought that Andy Nixon, an able young employee of Maine's Department of Economic Development, who has been assigned to work on this project, would have had much concern? Or who would have thought that Gardner Means, a world-famous New Deal economist who summers on an island in Machias Bay, which he owns, and is an economic advisor to the governor of Maine, who would have thought he would have had much interest in the North Slope? Well, these, of course, are only a few of hundreds of examples of the way in which Alaska oil development will reach out and touch the lives of people far, far away. So big potatoes or small potatoes, what may well happen on the North Slope is going to be significant potatoes to quite a few people. Now, there are messages for Dean Laudeman, George Hughes, Jim Crutchfield, Naomoto Komatsu, Robert Burledge, Dr. Kopach, Jane Wallen. Please pick up message from Vic Fisher at registration desk in lobby. And with that inspiring statement, this morning's session is adjourned.
That should wake everybody up. Ladies and gentlemen, please be seated. I don't expect that we'll have as many people here this afternoon as we had this morning because a number of concurrent sessions going on, I guess one or two. And I think that if people move in, it'll be easier for them to hear and easier also to participate in the discussion that we hope to have. We're going to time this session in a manner to assure that not only the presentations and the comments from the stage will be given, but provide as much time as we can for individual comments and questions from the floor, as well as some debate among the principal participants on the stage. This has given almost enough time for everyone to sit down. This afternoon's panel deals with petroleum, politics, and government. As those of you who may have seen the papers this past week and Anchorage News this morning, the session has been billed as a classic confrontation between a preeminent petroleum industry critic and the U.S. petroleum industry's leading spokesman. The object of neither this panel nor of this conference is, in our friend Wally Hickel's terminology, confrontation for confrontation's sake. Our purpose here is to bring to the fore the critical issues that face us today, that we'll have to face in the future. Our purpose is to understand better the forces that are at play now and that will affect the future of Alaska. The purpose is to help determine how to determine where the public interest lies and how it can best be protected. We need to help find out what the best strategies and the best means are to assure that while Alaska is being developed, and we're still talking about petroleum industry primarily, that the important values, the public values, are also properly taken care of. And if a little bit of controversy helps us attain these purposes, then confrontation is fine. But I don't think our purpose is just to get involved in arguments that won't be productive. We've heard a number of very interesting talks that pretty much lead into our discussion this afternoon. Some of the participants this morning actually touched on the politic of it all, on regulations, the interplay between industry and government. There was certainly enough to demonstrate to anyone who was not familiar with the prospects, the magnitude of what we're talking about in Alaska, what the future may hold. It is clear, certainly, that within a period of just a few years, Alaska has made a transition from a state that was concerned about eking out an existence almost not quite poverty-ridden, but certainly lacking a solid economic base, to a situation where we have a region here that gives promise to having a substantial per capita wealth, possibly the wealthiest state in the United States. Thus, from an economic and social standpoint, the benefits of petroleum development can be counted on the positive side. There are, of course, some important dangers. Some of them were touched upon this morning. We're all concerned about what may happen to the physical environment of Alaska in the process, and there'll be some more sessions on this particular issue over the next couple of days. Another danger, and I use the danger word advisedly, and one that concerns an increasing number of Alaskans, and again, I guess people outside, it was mentioned this morning, is the possibility that Alaska may be overwhelmed by outside forces, and that people may lose control over their own affairs, their own future, their own destiny. There's concern in view of the large stakes. The people and legislature may not find it possible to assure that the manner in which the petroleum industry develops Alaska will necessarily be consonant with the public interest. There's concern that these outside pressures may prevent the state from maximizing the benefits that can accrue to the public generally in terms of revenues to the state, in terms of proper regulation, and so on. Since the petroleum industry is in Alaska, and most Alaskans do realize the tremendous benefits that can accrue to the people and to the state from the industry's activities in Alaska, the question before us is really not, do we want petroleum development or not? Instead, we need to find out how, and I hope not whether, the state and the industry can coexist on a basis of mutual benefit. Toward this end, it is necessary for all of us to understand what the petroleum industry is, how it operates, how in turn it can be regulated and controlled in the public interest. It certainly looks as if Alaska and the industry will be living together for a long time to come. And our session today is really but what we look at as an initial discussion outside of the arena of political battle, and we have seen a few confrontations already over the last few sessions on specific issues. Now, we have assembled here a group of people who I hope will be able to deal with the issues that concern us. We want to look at first at the petroleum industry, not in terms of sort of how the petroleum industry describes itself, but in terms of through the eyes of someone who has taken a very detailed look and a very critical look, and I'd say a very controversial look. Thus, our first speaker is one whose work many of you may have read, his prime book on the topic being The Politics of Oil, Dr. Robert Engler.
Thank you. I think it's appropriate and welcome that people who are professionals or technicians, geologists, scientists, businessmen, are willing to ask larger questions about the political and social climate of their individual work. Because this failure, this what Veblen once called trained incapacity, or what I would call a trained innocence on the part of American professionals, is precisely one of the root factors in the tensions in this society that might well blow it sky high. And so it may be all right in looking back at the past to say, well, they didn't know. They couldn't anticipate the consequences. But as several of the speakers said today in different ways, I don't think that kind of an answer will suffice anymore. I don't think we can get away with the argument by saying, well, we just didn't know. I call my brief remarks New Frontiers for Old, and I ask the question, can a new state learn from the experiences of the rest of the nation and other raw material producing areas of the world? Or will Alaskans become so captivated by the prospects of wealth from petroleum that they will accept uncritically the definitions of individualism, development, private property, conservation, states' rights, and national security that have shaped so much of the nation's history? Right now, the nation is beginning to ask questions about the larger social costs incurred in creating an urban industrial society out of a frontier wilderness. At whose expense was this country built? Who was left out? With what consequences? The unthinking despoilation of priceless natural resources, the pollution of the physical, and probably more important, of the political environment, the gross disparities in income and living standards and opportunities, the uses of technology for narrow, acquisitive, manipulative, and destructive ends, the patterns of colonialism at home and abroad, the corrosion and capture of liberal political institutions, the anger and disaffection of young people and minorities, the emergence of an apolitical citizenry whose focus upon gadgetry and affluence often obscures a scaling down of their political power expectations in relation to the critical decisions affecting their lives. Each of these conditions has a root in the critical in social interpretations of the concept of individualism, of development, private property, conservation, states' rights, and national security, which have more often than not made them masks for short-sightedness and organized greed. Alaska is a big and untamed state. Alaskans may pride themselves on having the drive and the courage and the freedom of a frontier people, but they will have to deal not just with the challenges of a bountiful earth, but with the complexities of the corporate system. Increasingly, the industrial world is an elaborate man-made network of cause and effect. Its leaders seek planned, rational systems of order. The petroleum industry operates on a frontier of technological knowledge and economic organization. It has financial resources greater than those now available to most states and many nations. Wherever the industry has functioned, its concentrated economic power, the most massive of any industry in the world, has been forged into political power over the community. Law, the tax structure, the public bureaucracies, the political machinery, foreign policy, and public opinion have been harnessed for the private privileges and immunity from public accountability of the International Brotherhood of Oil Merchants. Formidable perimeters of defense, manned by public relations specialists, lawyers, lobbyists, and obsequious politicians and editors, keep the spotlight away from the permeability of oil. Instead, the focus is placed upon the mystique of petroleum technology, corporate benevolence, national security, and the possibility for an amenable public to be cut in on something for nothing. I can't hope in a few minutes to document that kind of a modest statement, but I must say I cannot pretend that I don't know this is so. And without trying to make an advertisement, I've tried to document each of these points. And one could go on for hours, and I still don't know anyone who's challenged any one of these points. Where does one start? For example, I'm just taking a few examples of this permeability. Every state that gets oil, becomes an oil-producing state, finds itself visited sooner or later by people, including from the American Bar Association, offering to set up model legislation for conservation. When I did my own homework on this around the country, I found that the minerals section of the American Bar Association was closely linked with all the lawyers who worked for the oil industry. And of course, the story of conservation as practiced in this country is one more illustration of mythology taking a sacred term and using it as a mask for private greed. Some of this was illustrated this morning, the way conservation, as generally employed in the oil industry, has very little to do with natural resources and much to do with private profit and privilege. If one combs every single agency of the United States government, as I have done, which touches upon oil, from the Bureau of Mines to the Department of Interior to the State Department to the Defense Department, you will find that wherever there are critical questions concerning oil, you will find either one, there are public servants who come directly from the industry and will return to it, or two, there are public servants whose view is generally that they will sooner or later enter the private service, or we will discover that, as is often true in the American political experience, we get government by co-opting the interests that compete for what they want. That is, we take them into the government. And so if you look at every single agency concerning oil, you'll discover that at the critical junctures, the people making public policy in the federal government, for example, are often advisors right from the industry. The National Petroleum Council within the Department of Interior represents all the major oil company heads and associations. They are advisory. But speak to any member of the Department of Interior and ask, where is the legitimate counterintelligence for a public philosophy, for a public policy? I can give many illustrations of how the National Petroleum Council, historically and contemporarily acting as advisor, ends up in effect making policy because it offers the kind of knowledge which the public government generally lacks. My favorite one, which may be an indulgence, but it's illustrative of the nature of the planning of the agency, of the industry, is on civil defense. And the National Petroleum Council was asked to prepare for the Secretary of Interior some years ago a manual on civil defense considerations and oil. And a study was called Disaster Planning for the Oil and Gas Industries, outlined steps for management to con- to consider for continuing plant operations under and after attack. Concern was voiced over the possibility that civil defense authorities might lack an adequate background for appreciating the special character of the oil industry. I quote, "It is conceivable that in the immediate post-attack period, the municipal fire equipment might be assigned to fight fire in dwellings or stores while an essential oil or gas facility was being destroyed by fire. To preclude this, the National Petroleum Committee, headed by the chairman of the Board of Standards of Indiana, recommended that management encourage appropriate supervisory personnel to take an active part in such organizations at the state and local level. There is not a single agency of government where oil has a stake which is not sooner or later permeated by representatives of the industry or by people who speak as public servants, but the only public they hear or seem to hear is that of a private position, of a private view. One can look at the whole range of foreign policy, which may seem remote to you at the moment, but I think it's related. The Iranians, for example. Iran once sat on what appeared to be the world's largest supply of crude. It had the largest refinery at the time in Abadan. And as you recall the story of in the 50s, the Iranians, increasingly discontent with their relationship as a raw material producer for the Western industrial world, demanded more and more terms for what became the British Petroleum Corporation. When Mossadegh took over in the 50s, the industry, the facilities were seized and nationalized. And for a little while, people in the Western world appeared to wonder, my God, where will our oil supplies come from? And some people in the eastern parts of the world assumed, now we really had this industrial Goliath by the jugular, because we control the raw material, and what will they do? Well, the answer what they did is quite simple. It's a long story, but it's quite simple. In the first place, the Iranians couldn't sell their oil. And now you may say, we're not Iranians, but I could go down a long list. I nearly constructed a speech based on what is an Alaskan and say, you're not Arabs, you're not Iranians, but who are you? And the Iranians discovered that they couldn't sell their oil. They could find freelance technicians, but they couldn't find the markets because the world markets were all tightly apportioned at the time. They couldn't find for a while tankers. They did begin after they tried to get aid from America and England. That's a long story. But in brief, at the very point, interestingly enough, where they made a deal with the Japanese and with Greek shippers to send some tankers of Iranian oil, Mossadegh was overthrown by the Central Intelligence Agency. This is not to argue that the United States government is a creature of the oil industry. This is not to argue that the Central Intelligence is a creature of the oil industry. That's too simplistic. But this is to argue that there's a very clear correlation and identity of interest between American public policy at national levels, and I could cite almost case after case in foreign policy, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Peru, you name the area, Cuba in part, and all the way down to the local level to such mundane issues as civil defense. Now, I want to say, be quite clear when I say this, that I don't think this is simply a matter of buying people or corrupting people in the obvious sense. One of the interesting facts of American life is that at least 25% of the land area of the United States is under lease to the oil industry. And that, in addition to that, perhaps another 25% of the public domain is eyed very carefully by the oil industry because of its interest in leases. And what this means politically is not hard to speculate about. It is rare, in fact, it's almost impossible ever to find a member of a congressional delegation, even today, with chimes are beginning to change, who will vote against the interest of, in quotes, the people of his state. And as the number of states gets oil, it appears that the legions of congressmen and senators who identify with the oil industry as the interest of their state appears to grow. There are some very interesting challenges to what I've just said today, and they bear real watching on depletion, on imports, and so forth. But I would like to say that also that the problem is not simply that of raw power or corruption. I think the problem is something much deeper in the nature of the American society, and the problem is the sharing of values very often. It said it takes two to make seduction. It also holds true for corruption. That is, it's very hard to find in the states where oil is discovered the businessmen, many of the public figures, many of the scientists and technicians who don't find it attractive or tempting to identify with the new men of oil, the interests of oil. And as I say, this can be understandable. This is not an attack on oil men. Oil men are often attractive individuals and have qualities which other pioneers can readily admire. They have contributed to the development and the comfort of the nation. Their investments are substantial, but their profit expectations are greater, and relatively little of the wealth that they remove from the earth remains with the people of the oil-producing regions. It's worth remembering that the oil industry did not create the oil. If you read carefully the fights over tax policy, for example, this confusion emerges as a basic premise. The primary objectives of the oil industry are corporate growth and profit. These objectives generally do not coincide with the needs of the greatest numbers of people. The critical questions to be raised by people thinking about the future of Alaska are moral questions and are hence political questions. They involve asking, what kind of a society is wanted, and to whom is it to be responsible? And I think the people of Alaska will have to ask themselves, with whom do they wish to identify themselves? I think all the people involved in regulating oil, the geologists, the technicians, the scholars who may find research projects generated by the study of oil, are going to have to ask themselves sooner or later, with whom do they really identify? And the fact that the lands, that the landlord in this state is public rather than private, changes some of the definition of the problem, but it doesn't really answer it. Because very bluntly, hypothetically, one could speculate that an oil man could tell you, if you believe corporate mythology, that he represents more people than you do, that the oil men are actually representatives of great bodies of stockholders. Presumably, anyone out of high school economics knows this is not exactly the way the corporate world works. But from the point of view of numbers, it is conceivable that oil people could say they represent great numbers of people. And you here in Alaska, who purport to represent 250,000, are a smaller group. I think the question, for whom do you really care to identify with, will come very clear as the development of oil continues. Will you expect your senators to join on the side of special tax privileges in favor of the depletion allowance? Will you expect your senators to join in fighting for import controls? If you do, from my perspective, you have joined a very small privileged group, and that you will be fighting, I think, one, against the interest of the greater number of people of this society, and two, I have a hunch, against the long-run interest of Alaska in relation to its own resources. I think the challenge has been said in different ways, is to develop a new experiment in democratic planning, which will respect the delicate balance inherent in nature and view resources as treasures for mankind rather than as private booty for individuals or for corporations, for states, or for nations. I think it's utter folly to leave your judgments as to what should be the development of this state in relation to oil to the competition of oil men or to vacuums of public policy. Despite all my own research on the nature of power, my interests are really not in power, but more closely with vacuums. And it's precisely the question of the vacuum which I think should be at the center of your attention. I think oil policy in general, to wind up and follow your chairman's admonition on time, should be placed in the context of the most comprehensive plan for all energy and industrial development. The related challenge, I think, is to search for ways to civilize technology before the emerging industrial process integrates all human behavior into corporate and bureaucratic ends. I think this means really examining the whole of your state political system to see how you can create a political system which would be genuinely responsible not to a small number of people, but to all of the 250,000, and also could identify with the larger interests of great masses of people throughout the world. I think the problem here is to develop a public service which will learn to understand oil and natural resources. And might I add, as much as we honor honesty or toughness or the cut of one's chin, I don't think these are qualities that will do in themselves. You'll need these, you'll need a high degree of knowledgeability, but you will also need a coherent social philosophy, because the public servant who operates without a social philosophy is very susceptible to the prevailing winds, which are generally in the direction of corporate profit and whatever else anyone else climbing on the bandwagon can get from it. Now, no public servant can operate in a vacuum. And I've known most of the public servants at one time or another who try to deal with oil. And I know something about their career records and their fates. I think the problem is not only to develop a social philosophy and the public servants with the knowledge to support that social philosophy, but also to develop a political constituency to support these views. Because what happens in almost every public servant I know in the Federal Power Commission, the Interstate Commerce Commission, the state regulatory agencies, every level, is that these people become isolated. And at best, they become neutral. And we're grateful when they're honest. But as champions of public philosophy, we rarely find them. And I think it seems to me that if Alaska could develop such planning and a body of citizens and public servants to support the wise control of the environment, it might then create rich opportunities for meaningful individual freedom and for a social system to which people could feel committed. In place of the tragic American record of loot and litter, Alaska might offer a new frontier of social organization from which we might all learn and take heart. My wife found a quotation in a Nigerian folk story, which is out of a song in which the people said, "Enjoy the world gently, enjoy the world gently. If the world is spoiled, no one can repair it. Enjoy the world gently."
Thank you, Bob. I think you've had a capsule of the theme of the analyses developed in the book, The Politics of Oil, and I have a hunch we may get into some of these points raised by Robert Engler a little bit more as we go on. Now, one of the things that he points out in this book and brought out here was the relationship, special relationship, I might emphasize, between the petroleum industry and government. And it was, of course, this area that we're interested in today. We're very fortunate to have with us the head of the American Petroleum Institute, which is the trade association of the industry. This is the organization that deals with big government in terms of public relations, negotiation, research, and so on. It's an organization that includes, I would assume, most of the major companies and probably most of the minor. And we're very interested now in hearing sort of from the industry side as to a view of how industry relates to government and you might say, an assessment from that particular point of view of the extent to which industry has a general interest in what government does, the special interest industry has, and if it's a special industry interest in government, what that particular interest is. Frank Eichardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure for me to be here today and to have this opportunity to participate in this discussion. I would hope as we go along that we do have a chance to have a little give and take and discussion of some of the issues that may be raised as we go along. We've heard a great deal today about this morning about Prudhoe Bay and the areas of Alaska that are now certainly in everyone's mind with reference to particularly the oil business and natural resources generally. To be somewhat repetitious, but yet I hopefully to bring this the importance of this area into focus, I think we could indicate again that the strikes in Prudhoe Bay, as Mr. Eckes indicated this morning, are greater than those that probably occurred in East Texas 40-odd years ago. But equally as significant, I think, is that we get some idea about the sequence of these kinds of strikes, in that you have one that occurs here. It's been some 40 years. And when you deal with this kind of discovery over this length of time, and I think you get an idea of the cost and the problems of general economic problems involved. I think the activities are certainly a testimony to the perseverance of many who have spent a great deal of time and a great deal of money there. I think it's also interesting to get some idea about the costs of operation, the cost of setting up a camp and equipping to drill is can amount to something in the order of two-thirds of $1 million. And the moving in and rigging up takes about 30 days, as against 5 to 10 days elsewhere in the United States. The drilling of a hole averages in the neighborhood of $20,000 a day, while elsewhere in the country it costs somewhere around $3,000. Engines at the drilling sites run around the clock, and the cost of fuel alone can exceed $3,000 a day. Now, the costs are only one thing, and the risks are certainly equally as great. There were 13 dry holes, I believe, drilled in the general area of Prudhoe Bay before there was a successful one, some ranging in the cost of something over $4.5 million, which gives some idea of the stakes that are involved. Now, the opening up of this great new horizon, or these great new reservoirs, brings into focus, I think, some of the national questions, which I would like to mention three or four very briefly here, as they affect the oil industry. Not necessarily in the order of importance, but all of concern to people generally and to the oil industry as such. One, and one that's currently under examination by the Congress, is a matter of tax policy. The tax treatment afforded the industry has been the same for approximately 43 years. This policy was developed after the amendment of the Constitution, provided for the taxation of income, and going through a period of trial and error where many different methods, many of which are now being suggested, were tried out, and some were found to be administratively not feasible, and others simply did not work for other reasons. So as a result of this experience, the present system was adopted and has been periodically reviewed since 1926, when it was adopted. The Senate will begin hearings on September the 4th on a bill that has passed the House, which, among other things, reduces the percentage depletion rate from 27.5 to 20. This is an issue of considerable importance to the industry, because it is this recoupment of the wasting asset, the capital recoupment, which, and also the provision of some kind of an incentive for the drilling of areas like the Prudhoe Bay, one that are so necessary for the development of the resources within the pattern that we know, and that is the corporate pattern that we have followed and which the previous speaker just took exception to. This debate will continue through this year and through probably a good many more. But I think it's safe to say that if the tax treatment is materially changed, then that the effect of this will be on the exploratory end of the business. And certainly the effect will be adverse and it will occur there. Now, the second issue or question that on the federal level that is of concern and currently under review is the whole imports program that has been in effect for something over 10 years, which regulates and controls the overall amount of imports into this country. It is based on the principle of national security, which the industry feels to be a valid one. I think somewhat misunderstood at times, but certainly a valid premise. This, again, is one that's interesting, I think, that some of the arguments about some of the critics of the import program say that we no longer need it on account of the activities in Alaska. But yet the irony, I think, of it is that but for the program, we would probably not have the reserves in Alaska developed. The whole area of imports is now being studied by a cabinet committee headed by Secretary Shultz of the Department of Labor, and it is expected that their report will be forthcoming sometime within the next few months. Now, the third area, and one I think that the industry has probably as much interest in as any other one that is now confronted, is this whole matter of environment and control of environment and the matters of air and water and surface. And we, I think you'll find that the industry as such, we do not question and in fact encourage the fact that these are public issues that should be controlled and regulated at the governmental level, that the industry itself is dedicated to doing everything within its power, recognizing the fact that its activities make a contribution, a substantial contribution, to the lack of quality in some areas of our environment, that we have an obligation which we intend to meet to do everything we can to see that this whole matter of as good an environment and as fine air quality and as fine a water quality as possible is maintained. As an industry, we have committed, I think, some of the finest scientific brains in the country, as a matter of fact, in the world, tackling some of the problems relative to environmental control. Economically, we as an industry have committed something in the order of $365 million a year to research, which over a period of 3 years will exceed $1 billion, working in this area of improving our environment. These, I think, are the issues that currently the industry is involved at the federal level, the three that are primarily before us, while there are many, many others. And certainly the first two, the matter of tax policy, the matter of import programs, are those provide the economic backup, the incentives for the development of new areas of natural resources in this country, such as those in Alaska. I was interested this morning when the question was asked if anyone here could recite how he was inconvenienced in the summer of '67 on account of the stoppage of the flow of some oil out of the Middle East into Western Europe or to this country. It seemed to me at the time that the question might better have been, how would you have been affected if the domestic industry in the United States had not been able to pick up the gap that was provided by the closing off of these supplies, both to Western Europe and the United States. I think if we look at it from that aspect, we can see that it was only the strength of a domestic industry that prevented a real economic crisis from occurring in the Western world in the summer of 67. So I think also when we talk about national security with reference to the import program, many of the critics are inclined, I think, to equate this to the military type of security. And I think what we're really talking about is whether or not the industrial machine of the United States, which is dependent, as was indicated this morning, for about three-fourths of its energy from the petroleum industry, must look to supplies outside and offshore the United States. Now, they will argue that the price of foreign oil or offshore oil is greatly less than that than our domestic supplies are. But I would suggest that the moment that we became dependent on these foreign supplies to the extent of at least 40% of our requirements, that the prices would no longer be cheaper. And you only have to look at what's happened around to see that this is the truth. So I think any industry, as large, as complex, and in many times as controversial as the oil industry, presents the kind of a silhouette that naturally is going to provoke question and controversy. With as many people involved in it as we have around the world and in this country, there are going to be some things done that shouldn't be done. And the public officials and the people, wherever they might be, that are critics of the industry, certainly not only have a right but an obligation to call these operations that do not meet the kind of standards that we would hope they would, not only to the public's attention, but to the attention of the appropriate people in government. I feel that the industry has, as I've indicated with reference to environmental questions, a very strong feeling, a very deep commitment to the fact that above everything else, it's our responsibility to do everything we can to see that we do not further diminish the quality of our environment, regardless of what it might be. Secondly, this does not mean that we have all the answers, and I'm not suggesting that, for instance, in the matter of automobile emissions, that we have reached the point by any means where we can be satisfied or anyone else can. But the important point is we are committed to a solution of this problem. We have dedicated the best people that we can find to it, and we have committed all of our resources to that end. So I would suggest that there must be a continuing dialogue between the oil industry and government at various levels, as there must be with any industry. Neither of us can live in a vacuum. We are committed to the private ownership and to the private, generally the private development of natural resources, as long as that is done in a way that it does not involve a corruption of the environment or in some way that's not in the public interest. We feel that the incentives that have been afforded the industry and the opportunities that are no greater than those afforded other industries to recoup our capital investment should be continued. And we feel that it's important to the economic future of this country that we have a strong and dependable supply of energy within our boundaries and within our control. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Frank. You've certainly provided the broad framework for what I hope will be a good follow-through discussion that where we can discuss some of the points and concepts and ideas, views you raise in terms of the, you might say, more practical situation in Alaska and the problems that will be faced here. We now go toward the more specific, we get a little bit closer to home. Our next speaker is Professor A.R. Thompson from now the University of British Columbia, formerly University of Alberta, a specialist in oil and gas law who has studied not just Canadian law and regulations, he's actually been involved in writing much, but also has studied petroleum activities in other countries. He has been to Alaska and looked at the situation here. And what we would like to hear from him is sort of an assessment of where we stand now in Canada and in Alaska with respect to legislation and regulations, and again, keeping in mind the basic theme of how, to what extent these are in the general public interest and affect public policies. Andy?
Thank you. You know, it takes an act of faith to believe that people really do learn from the experiences of others, and especially if that other is an outsider or a foreigner. It takes that kind of act of faith to believe that comparative studies of petroleum laws and legislation will really produce results. I have that kind of faith, but at the same time, either through realism or cowardice, you can decide, I began my paper by explaining a number of reasons why there are differences between Canada, northern Canada, and Alaska, which would suggest that maybe useful results, or many useful results, would not be expected. But I think this was cowardice, because I should have stressed the good reasons why comparative studies should bear fruits. And in fact, remarks of Professor Engler have made me appreciate all of a sudden that there are much closer reasons for identity between those of us in the western provinces and in northern Canada and those in Alaska than I had previously thought. You see, when he says to Alaskans, you can't justify yourself before those who condemn you in the future by saying you didn't know, and when he says to them, with whom do you identify?